In his latest book, Supreme City, How Jazz Age Gave Birth to Modern America, Donald L. Miller describes how jazz, theater, nightlife, and rising hemlines came to redefine New York, and he explores how the culture of the 1920s transformed both the city and the country as a whole. His book is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased that it brings Donald Miller, the John Henry McCracken Professor of History at Lafayette College, to our show today. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard.
Despite the title of your book, you say in your preface, New York City didn't so much give birth to modern America as much as it was a cultural reflection of America at the time. So which came first, Jazz Age Manhattan or Jazz Age America?
Jazz Age America came first. It starts in New Orleans, goes up to Chicago, hits New York, but then it goes out to the country from New York City, from the Cotton Club. Bill Paley, one of the founder of CBS Radio, goes up to the Cotton Club. He visited it regularly, and then he puts Duke Ellington on the air, and he goes national. And that, along with Ellington's phonograph records, really created a national sensation and made New York's music kind of the music of the country.
But, of course, Ellington came from Washington, D.C. In fact, his first band was called the Washingtonians.
Right.
Louis Armstrong came here from Chicago, started New Orleans, of course. They were all coming to New York.
Yeah. Yeah, I found that when I was finished with a book, I counted my characters. I have about 33 major characters. It's an overlapping list of biographies. And just about all of them came from outside the cities. You know, blazingly ambitious drivers coming to New York, and some defeated by the city and some triumphant. And they're the people who really give the city its zip, its edge.
Had New York already become the place where you had to make it? If you can make it here, you can make it anywhere by the 1920s?
It had. But in the 20s, what's happening is New York is caught between two eras. You have the industrial era, and it had always been the commercial center of the country, the publishing center of the country, the entertainment center of the country. But in the 20s, you got a new age of communications along with the old railroad age. And New York has both. It has a great harbor. It's got a great railroad system. But now it becomes a center of mass entertainment. And that goes out to the country over radio, which is founded in New York City.
Much of your book is about the destruction of the old Midtown Manhattan and the development of a new one. What was being destroyed?
Well, the old Manhattan, Midtown, was there. When I started this book, I was going to do a book about, all of New York, all the boroughs, and I thought it was too big a story. And so I focused in on this. What I thought was surprised to see was an untold story, this sudden and spectacular eruption of Midtown. There were Vanderbilt mansions on Fifth Avenue. Before the 1920s. It was called Vanderbilt Alley up from 42nd Street up to the park. In addition, of course, there's Grand Central Station, Grand Central Terminal, as it was called, and that's a pre-World War.
Grand Central Station is the post office, as my listeners often remind me when I get it wrong.
Exactly. Yeah. And Hell's Kitchen. And all of a sudden, in the 20s, the New York Central Railroad covers its railroad yard, electrifies the trains, buries them, and creates modern Park Avenue. All the Vanderbilt mansions are raised by aggressive young, mostly real estate agents who come out of New York City, out of the ghetto, as it were, Benjamin Winter and people like that. And they create modern Fifth Avenue, Saks Fifth Avenue, Bergdorf Goodman's, and it becomes a regal shopping center. The only thing that is in along the river, Sutton Place, which is a decaying neighborhood, is gentrified by people who move from, many of them grand dames from the old Vanderbilt mansions, widows.
You cite the completion of Grand Central Terminal in 1913 as the start of the new Midtown. What was there before the terminal was built?
Well, there was an old railroad station there, and it had become, by 1905, it had become obsolete.
Well, it was open 3 years after Penn Station. Was it seen as the next step, or was it
seen the new Grand Central Terminal?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The one that really started that whole transformation.
Yeah, William Wilgus's, that was his handiwork, really. And there's a modernization of the station. As I mentioned, the trains are electrified, submerged, and this brand-new building goes up. It's a stairless building. I call it a great people mover.
How did the building influence the whole area architecturally and otherwise?
Well, the company, the New York Central Railroad, who owned the station, they owned a vast tract of land that was this former railroad yard. I mean, there were no cross streets above the station all the way up to 59th. You had to go across iron bridges.
The grid didn't exist up there?
Yeah, the grid didn't exist. There was nothing there but a massive, smoky, sooty railroad yard. And you went across there. There were sparks flying up there, smoke and things like that. And there was a terrible railroad accident in one of the tunnels, which was really the precipitant for the building of the new station and the electrification of the trains. So the Central owns all this land. And what they do is on the roof of the station, they start selling the lots that they own to real estate developers, which means they can control development. And so you get on Park Avenue, and modern Park Avenue is really a creation in the 1920s of a railroad company. And it went up with spectacular suddenness. And people called the entire area then in the 1920s Terminal City.
The reason Park Avenue is so wide and has that meridian is because the trains are running underneath it?
Exactly. Exactly. Originally, there were vents for the old steam locomotives, which were located right in the central garden, you know, that divided the two parts of the avenue. But all that's gone, of course, with the silent electric trains.
Did this new train station attract other kinds of businesses? It took 15 years or so.
It's a massive.
The Chrysler Building doesn't go up till 1928.
It's a massive magnet. Of course, the war slows down everything, but after the war, there's this tremendous real estate boom, and you have what I consider the greatest city building movement in its time span, the greatest city building movement in all of history.
When you say the war, you meant World War One?
World War One, exactly. Yeah, and modern Midtown is a creation really of it erupts out of this unprecedented real estate boom.
Also, some pretty good architects around at the time.
Absolutely. Raymond Hood, Radiator Building, one of my favorite buildings.
That's across from Bryant Park?
Across from Bryant Park. You have a library across the street. You have the park. It doesn't overwhelm the streetscape. It's not overwhelmingly tall. It's only 17 stories tall. I much prefer that to the Daily News Building, which is built in an area they call then the Valley of Giants, with the Chrysler Building, the Channon Building, and things like that.
Well, the newspapers were originally all downtown near Park Row.
Yes.
When did they start moving uptown? The Times, the Herald Tribune, the Daily News?
They start moving uptown in the 1920s, and the New York Times comes uptown. And Joseph Patterson comes in from Chicago, Patterson of the Pattersons who built the Chicago Tribune, going all the way back to the 1850s, and he forms the first American tabloid newspaper, the Daily News. It looks like it's created on a shoestring. The Tribune Company controlled his finances, and they weren't going to dribble out money to this cheesy tabloid, as they thought it was. It almost doesn't make it, but by 1925, it's the largest-selling newspaper in New York City. By 27, it's the largest-selling newspaper in the world.
And imitated like mad. In fact, Hearst does the Mirror, and then
absolutely.
We see tabloids all over the world.
Yeah, and then up goes the Daily News Building on West 42nd. And that's one of my major themes. I mean, the New York I describe is still very much here. You can walk around, even the 21 Club, et cetera, the Chrysler Building, Channon Building, the Fred French Building, Tudor City. But what I try to do is get behind the buildings to the people who built them. And I think architecture is autobiography. I walk in, for example, to the Channon Building, and it's dedicated to the theme of City of Opportunity. Because Channon, he's from Bensonhurst. In 1919, he's a veteran, he's broke. And he's building two small houses in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. 10 years later, has the richest real estate empire in New York City. And this whole theme is there blazingly on display in the lobby of the Channon Building, which of course is right across from Grand Central Terminal.
You devote a lot of your book to some of the lesser-known public figures of the time. Are these people we should know better?
I think so.
Fred French?
Fred French, absolutely. I mean, I came across Fred French in a Don DeLillo novel where two of the characters walk into the beautiful lobby of the building. Again, that's still there on Fifth Avenue. And they say, who in the world is Fred French? Well, he's one of the most important. He's a Babbitt with brains. I mean, he's got a lot of gumption. He's a salesman. He makes an immense fortune selling real estate bonds to common people. I mean, off the market, off Wall Street. And he also builds, in addition to the Fred French Building, which is the first skyscraper built north of 42nd Street. There are no skyscrapers north of 42nd Street before 1919. By the end of the decade, half of New York skyscrapers are there. And French also builds Tudor City, which still exists. It's a great in-town, a great example of affordable in-town living.
Now, skyscrapers, there are a lot of skyscrapers in downtown Manhattan, and then not any until around 30-something Street, the Empire State Building, 34th Street. And then, as you say, they continue all the way up, I guess, up to Central Park.
Yes.
Is this simply because of the schist of Manhattan, or are there other factors?
For a long time, it was the geological explanation that the schist dipped deep in that area, and it was hard to sink caissons all the way down there. But lately, a group of architectural and business historians have found that skyscrapers tend to be located very close to mass transit systems and the subways, and that more than geology was driving the development of these things.
So because we had Penn Station and Grand Central Terminal,
they pulled New York their way. I mean, the Commodore, even when he built the station in the 1850s and 60s, realized that it was considered too far. Well, he was criticized for building a station too far north of the commercial downtown, but New York kind of came to him. Yeah, it really did.
And now we call it Midtown, but it isn't even Midtown.
No, it's not Midtown anymore.
It's kind of one-thirds town.
Exactly.
Donald L. Miller's book, Supreme City, How Jazz Age Manhattan Gave Birth to Modern America, is published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Donald L. Miller. His book, Supreme City, How Jazz Age Manhattan Gave Birth to Modern America. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We were talking about some of the newspapers moving uptown. Publishing in general moved to Midtown. You have the McGraw-Hill Building, also a Raymond Hood Building.
Yes.
The New Yorker started publishing around that time, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Was it already seen as a symbol of New York sophistication when it started?
From the very beginning, it set out to be an expressly New York publication. It went out to the world, of course, but primarily in the 20s, it's a New York magazine, a New York-based magazine. And
when did the skyline become one of those things that immediately told you, New York? Like, I remember the movies that, so many movies that started off with a camera that was probably in New Jersey somewhere that showed the skyline, and then a boat would be moving across the Hudson River, and next thing you know, we would be in a skyscraper somewhere in Midtown Manhattan.
Yeah. It starts in the late 1920s. The Fred French Building kicks it off, and of course, the consummate building for me was a Chrysler Building. I mean, with its magnificent silver spire. And of course, then you have, it's only the tallest building in the world for 11 months until the Empire State Building goes up. But just across the way, as I mentioned, is the Channon Building. That was all lit up at night. It looked like a floating island in the sky.
Would they have been possible if the idea of a steel skeleton hadn't been derived, or the development of the elevator?
The elevator and the steel frame invented concomitantly in Chicago and New York really drove this thing. And I try to tell that story in the book through the Mohawk Indians, a lot of whom worked on the skyscrapers in New York, the high iron men who worked up there where the birds don't fly.
Now, architecture is just wonderful in Chicago, but why is New York the city that we associate with skyline?
Well, it's the New York skyline is a lot showier than the Chicago skyline. Chicago buildings were really form follows function, and that's Louis Sullivan's idea. In New York, it's the architecture is, like the Chrysler Building itself is a big commercial bulletin board for the Chrysler Motor Company, and so many New York buildings are like that.
Well, Louis Sullivan did design one building on Bleecker Street in Manhattan, and New York pretty much destroyed it, stripped it of all of its beautiful ornamentation, just another one of those buildings.
Yeah, you got, you know, Burnham Building, the Flatiron Building, that still stands.
We did import some of those Chicago architects.
Oh, yeah, I wrote a book on Chicago that included all those architects, you know, and Frank Lloyd Wright wanted to build a skyscraper in New York, tallest building in the world.
Yeah, he wanted to build a mile-high skyscraper.
Mile-high skyscraper.
He said that you could stick everything in it and then just have a low-rise family housing for the rest
around
of the city.
In your prairie city, yeah.
That didn't catch on. What do you think?
There was a big fight in New York about height limits, much like you have today. People thought that the city was just building the skyscrapers too closely together and far too high, turning the streets into canyons and creating wind tunnels and things like that. So there's a huge public debate in 1927 about this that very much replicates a debate that's taking place about the modernization, if you will, of East Manhattan. You know, the bill that was defeated in city council that the Bloomberg administration proposed to build enormous skyscrapers, a whole set of them right around Grand Central Terminal.
Was zoning a big issue in the 20s?
Absolutely. The buildings you see in Midtown that are creatures of the 1920s were built not under unrestrained capitalism. They were built, you know, to the strictures of a pretty tough zoning law, which provided – it's why you have what's called wedding cake architecture.
The ziggurat look.
The ziggurat, which brings light and air onto the streets. Exactly.
Were the changes affecting the population of the city? Was it bringing in different kinds of people?
Absolutely. But there is, in the 20s now, there's a Johnson Act that's passed by the Senate, signed by the president, and that really delimits immigration dramatically. And the city kind of settles down a lot. There isn't this inpouring of immigrants, and you won't have it. The immigrant population rising again with any great degree until the 1950s.
You referred to Jazz A's New Yorkers as Metropolitanites. What characterized the Metropolitanites at the time?
Well, that's a term that the New Yorker used. And these were people that the New Yorker appealed to, young, very sophisticated, the kind of people who spent summers often in Europe. New York's a city of the sea, and the ocean liner plays a big part in my book. I mean, here you could dock these liners right, unlike any city in the world, right in Midtown, and they were almost part of the city.
What other culture and art defined the Jazz Age? You write about the Roxy Theater.
Roxy is one of my favorite characters of the entire book. I mean, he exemplifies one of these strivers. He comes in, you know, he's a baseball player in Scranton, Pennsylvania. He marries a local girl, builds a movie theater to show flickers in the back room of his father-in-law's bar, puts up a sheet, gets a projector, borrows chairs from a funeral home when there was a body on display in the funeral. We had to pull the chairs out. And 5 years later, he's in New York running some of the biggest theaters. And he specializes in these things called prologues. As Marcus Lowe said, we don't sell tickets to movies. We sell tickets to theaters. There weren't enough good movies to pack the theaters. And Roxy builds this cathedral of the motion picture, 6,000 people. And the motion picture might last an hour, and the prologue, four.
Almost every neighborhood in New York had a grand movie palace.
They did.
That was probably built in the 20s.
Yes.
And all of them, the ones that survive now, are multiplexes.
Yes.
And you'd never know that they were these amazing places. But a lot of them have just been torn down.
They have. I mean, the movies took over Times Square in the 20s, and they pushed legitimate theater to where it is today on the side streets. I mean, if you went from, you know, got off at 42nd Street and walked north toward the movie theaters, there was just this army of people, you know, around 7:30 at night, just moving into these large motion picture theaters.
Even though New York was no longer the center of movie making, it most recently has become one again.
Exactly. Well, Darrow Zanuck said it. You know, if New York approves, the rest of the world will approve. And so the premieres, the big premieres, usually took place in Manhattan.
The Jazz Age wasn't just about the arts. Politically, the city was under the control of Tammany Hall.
Mm-hmm.
How did the politics of the time interact with the cultural changes?
Well, the mayor, Jimmy Walker, expresses that. I mean, he was exuberant. He was flashy. He was stylish. He was
called
a Broadway
Bo James.
Guy. Bo James. He wanted to be a songwriter more than a politician. And I think most biographies, there have only been two of Walker, substitute anecdote for analysis. And what I try to do in this by working with the Walker papers down at the Public Archives is really get a nuanced picture of Jimmy Walker. He's not just the caricature that you see him. I mean, he created New York's first planning department. New York had no public sewage system. He created the first waste disposal systems. He built hospitals. Now, admittedly, you know, he took, you know, money from friends, but they could never get him quid pro quo, this bundle of cash for that public improvement that's going to benefit, you know, the giver. And they investigated him down to his toenails.
Gene Fowler's biography of him, Bo James, was a bestseller, and then Bob Hope played him in a movie.
Bo James.
Called Bo James. Yeah. They romanticized him, made him into a kind of a dandy, and forgot about his role as an effective mayor?
I don't know if he was an effective mayor. I don't think he had the endurance, the physical endurance. I don't think he had the moral courage to battle the bosses of Tammany.
Well, he was brought down by scandal.
Exactly. But he was no mere creature of the bosses. I mean, he did battle them on that, on those planning commission and waste disposal systems, which they wanted no part of. They wanted no part of anything that came out of City Hall. The borough presidents were little czars within their own boroughs, and they wanted to control public improvements in their areas. So Walker's not like that. But he does eventually get worn down. And they do investigate him. They got him out of the way primarily because Roosevelt's going to run for president. And you can't have a major scandal like this. It has to be exposed and expunged.
Well, he was Al Smith's boy.
He was Al Smith's boy. And Smith, even Smith turned against him and said, Jimmy, it's time to go.
We're talking about a time when prohibition was the law. Mm-hmm. And yet when I think of Jazz Age New York in the 20s, I think about movies and books that have a lot of drinking in them.
Yeah. Well, what I found about Prohibition New York is my central character in telling that story is Oney Madden. He comes out of Hell's Kitchen, and he's the real boss of Midtown. And he forms a syndicate that the federal government was never able to completely uncover and prosecute to the hilt. Frank Costello joined it, a guy named Big Bill Dwyer. It's the biggest bootlegging syndicate in the country. They put Costello on trial. It was a hung jury. They put Dwyer away for 1 year. When he came back after less than a year, he was made commissioner of the American Hockey Association. But he really captures it because he's delivering a product to people. He's operating like a political boss, a lot like Al Capone did. He's popular in Hell's Kitchen. He has an enormous brewery down there selling Madden's Number One, this foamy draft beer, and he controls nightclubs. He wants to control the supply of the beer, and he wants to control the delivery of the beer as well.
And beer was made in Manhattan and Brooklyn. In fact, the owners of the Yankees owned Rupert's.
Rupert.
One of the worst beers I've ever drunk in my life. But that's we've come a long way as far as beer is concerned.
Yes,
the role of women was changing as well during this time.
Absolutely,
was that obvious in New York City?
Oh yeah, I mean, two of the central characters in my book are two immigrants: Elizabeth Arden, the daughter of a Canadian farm girl, and Helena Rubinstein, who's the daughter of a Krakow kerosene dealer. And they come in here and build the modern beauty business, which is among the 10 largest industries in the country by the time they're finished. They're multimillionaires, and their shops are on Fifth Avenue right in Midtown.
Was New York a center of the suffrage movement?
It was. It was. And the suffragettes are very strong. And actually, Helena Rubinstein and Arden picked up a theme from that. Of course, every woman has a right to vote. They said every woman has a right to be beautiful. So the ideas around there, if you use paint and powder, you were considered, a woman of ill repute. And by the middle 20s, it's a badge of independence.
We talked about how this spread to the rest of the country. How evident would this have been in Omaha, Nebraska?
Well, it gets around. One of Duke Ellington's musicians.
Duke Ellington don't get around much anymore.
No. But, in the 20s, because one of his musicians said that constantly the Cotton Club was flooded with tourists. And people would come in from Hope, from, Duluth and places like that and say, we're getting it. We're getting the music on the air. We're getting the Jack Benny on the air. We're getting, New York comedy on the air. So this is really the great transmitter of New York culture. People like Sarnoff and Paley, they're the giants of the industry, NBC and CBS, and they create the first national radio network. So even the World Series goes out there.
On the other hand, New York remains segregated. In fact,
absolutely,
African Americans couldn't go to the Cotton Club. They could perform there, but if they were allowed in, they were always put in a special section.
Yes.
And New York was as slow to integrate as any city in the country, except for the fact that Jackie Robinson broke the color line in Brooklyn.
Absolutely, absolutely. There were a lot of black entertainers downtown as well. Ellington gets a start downtown in a place called Club Kentucky. But it's a small, place, cellar basement, a basement, a speakeasy run by gangsters. But big crowds down there. But again, it's a white audience black entertainment, and that's the trademark of the era.
Did the Depression change everything, or was it already on the way?
No, I try to see this book without. I call it one of the great historical fallacies, the fallacy of the hindsight. Hindsight is supposed to give you perspective; it often distorts. I try to tell this story through the eyes and lives of people who don't know what's coming. You know, the Irving Berlin song, blue skies, and nothing but blue skies. And if you start to see it and tell it backward and you know the Depression's coming, it becomes a very different story. And it doesn't come to life in the way that, and you don't see the decisions in front of the people before they make them.
It's interesting that when you see movies of the 30s, movies that take place in New York, even if they're shot in Hollywood, right. Many of the people are going to the fancy nightclubs. They're dressed to the nines. You'd never know that people were starving.
No,
you
wouldn't.
Selling apples on the street.
No, you wouldn't. And that's what Hollywood was about in the 1920s, 30s, trying to get people to forget about the Depression.
But did New York see itself that way?
No, I don't think the city saw itself that way, but the film industry certainly wanted the country to see it that way.
You have a number of events that are coming up?
I do. I'm appearing at the Skyscraper Museum tomorrow night at 6:30, and RSVP is necessary, but it's free.
Uh-huh. How do people RSVP?
Online at the Skyscraper Museum.
Actually, there are links on our show page at WNYC.org.
There you go.
So if you want to go and you want to RSVP, go to WNYC.org and check out that and any other thing that Donald L. Miller is doing in the near future in connection with his book, which is called Supreme City, How Jazz Age Manhattan Gave Birth to Modern America. The book is published by Simon & Schuster, has a beautiful photograph of the Chrysler Building on its cover. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you. It was a great pleasure.